Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The volume of crisis calls at the North Central Mental Health Services Suicide Prevention Hotline spiked some 21% last year, much of that due to economic stress on so many Americans, and everybody knows what we're talking about there. But suicide pretty much has remained stable. The rate of suicide in the nation has remained stable, despite decades of study and millions spent on prevention services like the hotline. Joining us today to talk about that and how we view suicide and how that determines our treatment of it is James Rogers. He's professor of education at the University of Akron. Dr. Rogers also is president of the American Association of Suicidology. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be here.
And with us in the studio is Mary Brennan Hoffman. She is coordinator of suicide prevention services at North Central Mental Health Services. Mary, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ann. I'm glad to be here, too.
As I said at the outset, suicide rates overall are stable. But shouldn't the rate decrease with our increased study of suicide, Jim?
Well, that's an interesting question, and one that I have grappled with for quite some time. We can go back to the 1950s mm-hmm. and look at rates, and we see that in general, they have remained relatively stable in the United States. There have been spikes here and there, but overall pretty stable. And so it has led, a lot of folks in the research and the prevention and intervention area to really focus on just the alleviation of distress a bit more and looking at how many folks we reach out to, for example, in hotline kinds of activities, because it seems as though that death by suicide as an indicator of our success is really hard to struggle with.
You've been doing working at this, Mary, for 22 years.
Yes.
The rate hasn't changed. The spikes notwithstanding, the rate hasn't changed overall. Have you noticed anything change though?
Well, it is pretty stable. I think one of the big things that we are kind of focused on is that it's not just suicide deaths that we're concerned about, but suicidal attempts, mm-hmm. suicidal thoughts, the whole range.
Do we know if suicide attempts has gone up, Jim or Mary?
I don't know.
and that you're more successful at stopping them, perhaps?
Well, we certainly know that on our hotline, we kind of keep track of what's going on, and we have every month between maybe 10 and 20 callers who we would consider pretty high risk. Either they've already taken pills or they have a weapon there and we're not able to distance them. So we intervene in those cases. So I don't know if you want to count them or figure out if they would have died if they took this many pills. But, we do know we're intervening in some pretty serious cases.
Well, one of the challenges with trying to make that determination is, while we do keep good track in the United States in terms of deaths by suicide, we don't really have a national database or registry for folks who make non-lethal suicidal behaviors. If they end up in a hospital, perhaps, we have some records of those folks. And so the best that we can do right now is make estimates of the number of folks who engage in those kinds of behaviors. And a number of people have contributed to the idea that the American Association of Suicidology puts forth, is that somewhere around 25 non-lethal suicidal behaviors to every one death by suicide. But that's likely to be a very conservative estimate. A lot of folks engage in those kinds of behaviors and never come to the attention of either law enforcement authorities or hospitals. So we really don't know. However, what we do know from the research and units like Mary's is that they do reach out to folks who are struggling. And very often, although we have some difficulty following up on those folks oftentimes, we do know that very often we can intervene in ways that pull people back from the edge of engaging in those kinds of behaviors.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. We're talking about suicide with Dr. James R. Rogers, a professor at the University of Akron Counseling, Department of Counseling and Psychology, and also Mary Brennan Hoffman with the Suicide Prevention Services Coordinator in Columbus. You know, when I was preparing for this, I was interested in some of jargon's not the right word, but the lexicon of the discussion at the research level, and it sounded almost like suicide is like a disease. There were words like epidemiology and that kind of stuff used with the research, and it made me think about, all right, suicide's been pretty stable over the last 50 or so years. Is it sort of like that intractable thing, like you're going to always lose a certain number of people to flu?
I think that's an interesting question, Ann. And although one of the things that I would say about the lexicon or the nomenclature, mm-hmm. those kinds of things, is you have to remember that the study of suicidology or the field of suicidology is very multidisciplinary. For example, our group, the American Association of Suicidology, consists of members who are psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, nurses, volunteer workers, folks who have lost somebody by suicide, anthropologists, sociologists, just a wide variety of disciplines involved, and each of those disciplines may have some differences in the way they talk about suicidal behaviors. And from a medical model perspective and a public health model perspective, we certainly talk about epidemiology and incidence and prevalence and those kinds of things. As we get more to disciplines that focus on treatment, oftentimes what you find is much more of a humanistic or what I would say an existential perspective that, you know, suicide often has a strong component of a search for meaning in somebody's life. And so because of this multidisciplinary perspective, you hear suicidal behaviors talked about differently and approached differently. So I think that's that's something that we need to keep in mind. It is a very complex kind of behavior.
That's what I was going to say.
And you know, certainly years ago when we started really seriously looking at the issue of suicide in the United States, which was somewhere around the late 50s, the hope was that we could find some real simple kinds of differences between folks who die by suicide and folks who don't engage in those kinds of behaviors, but that hasn't panned out for us.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, how do you study suicide? How do you conduct a psychological autopsy? How do you get behind that when the person's gone? It's not like the human body.
And again, that's the difficulty. We're interested in learning about a behavior that we can't just watch. Morally and ethically, if we feel mm-hmm. that somebody's at risk for suicide, we need to intervene. And so where other approaches in other areas, you may identify people at risk for something and then do a treatment and a control group study, we can't do it here because the ultimate outcome could be death. And so that makes it a very challenging kind of area to study. You mentioned psychological autopsy, and that is, you know, kind of like the primary method of learning what we think we know about folks who die by suicide is a process of having someone or a team of folks investigate by talking with the loved ones and coworkers and associates of someone who has died by suicide to kind of recreate what their life was like the 2 weeks prior to suicide. So some of the things that we think we know have come from that direction. Some of the things that we think we know have come from looking at folks who have made suicide attempts and have lived. So those non-lethal suicidal behaviors. However, there's a big question as to what extent characteristics that we find from those folks might actually be the same as folks who die by suicide. So it remains an enigma as we think about trying to identify what are a few things that we could identify folks with and be sure to intervene. And that's part of why we have not made progress, I think, in reducing the suicide rate.
Mary, how has your service changed over time to reflect the changing knowledge base? It's more about what you don't know in some cases, but...
Well, I think one thing is we have more outreach, not just doing intervention, but doing more prevention.
In other words,
work.
Not waiting back for sitting back right. and waiting for the call to come.
Right,
in.
Mm-hmm. And a couple programs we have an outreach actually to suicide attempters, and what Dr. Rogers was saying about it's hard to tell how many. It really is difficult, but what we count is because we have the Columbus Police Department's reports. It's public record. we do count and kind of examine the suicide attempts that involve a police run each month, and there's about 50 or so a month. So that isn't including, the suicides that never got police attention or no one else knew or they didn't get hospitalized. But so that's one outreach program we have. We've also tried to kind of identify what the current, precipitating factors are for our callers. What are they concerned about? And then, trying to get good referrals on that specifically for those areas.
A person who calls into a hotline, though, that's a category in a way. Some people never would consider calling into a hotline.
Sure, sure. And, there's been some research about that, who are the people that call, and there's more women than men. Although mm-hmm. I have noticed that has also evened out a lot more over the past, 10 years
in
or
terms
so.
Of the people who call.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's, fewer women, more men are calling for us. It's kind of hard to quantify sometimes.
We're going to take a short break and then we'll get to some calls when we return. If you would like to comment or join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be back in a little while. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine at 247-4469. And thank you for supporting WOSU 820 NPR News. And support for WOSU comes from Ohio Wesleyan University, congratulating its students on receiving the Presidential Award for Higher Education Community Service. Last year, nearly 1,800 Ohio Wesleyan students gave their time and talent to help others. OWU.edu. 57 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:19, a beautiful day today, sunshine and a high near 60. Clouds tonight, a good chance of rain tonight as well, and a low of 42. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about suicide right now with James Rogers. He's a professor at the University of Akron in counseling and psychology, and also Mary Brennan Hoffman. She's suicide prevention services coordinator at the North Central Mental Health Services. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's take a call right now. Dale, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. At the risk of kind of destroying all the statistics that these two people have about suicide, I would probably suggest, based on my personal experience with my personal train wreck colliding with the economic plane crash of the economy, that there are a number of people out there who, because they refuse to accept suicide as a backdoor out of life kind of thing, and it's just not acceptable, are suffering, enormous things. And they go through life and they take, go through the steps, but nothing seems to make life better. Comments on that?
In other words, they want to die, but they don't think that suicide is an option.
No, it's a backdoor out of life. Come on.
Okay.
I mean, personally, this is my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I personally think it's a backdoor out of life. And my fate in death is when my fate will be, and I refuse to be a part of that decision. But that being said, there are times when you want to die. You just don't want to go on because nothing is working out. And you've had a great life up to a certain point, and then all of a sudden everything just crashes down.
So I guess it's sort of, thank you, Dale, for your call. I guess it's sort of like another category of suicidal behavior. Jim?
Well, I would, what I would say is I certainly understand, you know, what in some respects what Dale's talking about, and one of the positive things is that while many of us have come to places in our lives where we've said this doesn't seem to be worth going on, we find ways to tough it out, if you will. I think that for folks like Dale, they're one of the things that we do know, and which is even embedded in the work that Mary does, is that connection with a caring individual who can listen and help develop alternatives and options in one's life can often be very helpful. I mean, we tend to sometimes get into situations where our perfect solution isn't going to be available, and it's often helpful to meet with or talk with somebody who at least has a good ear for us and can help us think about alternatives to what we've been doing to our situation. Now, there are some things like the economy that at certain points there seems to be little that we can do there, and that's why it's so necessary to bring somebody else in to listen. That's why hotlines are so invaluable in our communities.
Yes, and I would like to say, too, that you know we're really happy that people have reasons not to kill themselves, and not everyone who calls our line is suicidal. About 1 out of 3 says no when we ask the suicide question. But certainly you may not be at the point of suicide, or you may be thinking about it, but because of your religious or personal beliefs, you know, you would never do it. But we're there on the hotline also to help folks like Dale that, you know, are having problems. And sometimes, you know, just talking and having someone listen can help. Sometimes we can find resources that you might not be aware of. And really just to know that, you know, you're not alone can sometimes make a difference for our callers.
Dale, thanks for your call.
Surely.
Take care.
I'll give it a try.
You do that. You know, Dale brings up a really good point. And so did you about, you know, finding people to talk to. I was reading a Washington Post article. It said that it was referring to a 1985 survey that asked how many confidence do you have? And the respondents, the most frequent answer was 3. That was in 1985. In 2004, the same study went out, same question, and the most frequent answer was none. Jim, what do you make of that?
Well, it's easy to, do technological bashing in some respects, you know, mm-hmm. but we've gotten so connected in superficial ways to folks that I think that it is a big loss for us, and I think for our society in that we have become a tendency to become so disconnected from other folks, and there are clearly some data that suggests that this. For men, even finding somebody to talk to and being willing to talk to someone about their struggles is very difficult. My fear is that the trend continues. We can't have a minus one on that listing, but I don't see how things are improving in any way the way our society is moving.
I think that's really true, too, because with the internet and the computer and texting and all that, it really doesn't take the place of talking to a real person. And we've had callers who call and say, you're the first person who's ever really listened to me. So obviously, even though it takes a lot of time when people are networking and Facebook and all that, it's not necessarily as emotionally satisfying or you know, the person may feel, yeah, they're connected, but they don't. People don't really know them or they don't really care.
Let's take another call. If you want, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Tom, you're on the air with Jim Rogers at the University of Akron and Mary Brennan Hoffman at the Suicide Preventions Coordinator in Columbus.
Yes, thank you. Have there ever been any studies that would show a higher or lower incidence of suicide in any particular occupation, profession, age group, etc.?
And gender, too. Yeah, there's been lots of studies. Thanks for your call, Tom. You want to talk about some of those? Those statistics are fun to bandy about, but I don't ever know quite what to make of them. Women, middle-aged women, are more likely to attempt suicide than their male counterparts, but men are more likely to succeed at the deed.
Well, one of the reasons I asked this many years ago, I heard that a study had shown that dentists had the highest rate of suicide.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't read the study, but I think it caught my interest because I'm a dentist.
That'll do the trick.
So have that, either of you ever heard that?
Well, actually, studies like that are, folks look at those kinds of things in statistics all the time. And I do recall some time ago, for whatever reasons, dentists were up pretty high. I think the most recent statistics that I've heard of place pharmacists up fairly high. And if you look at those different categories, you know, for any one year or across a number of years, you can find some differences, but they do fluctuate. One of the questions is, why might that be? And we have a lot of guesses about those kinds of things, you know, responsibility for, you know, healthcare decisions, things of those sorts. But at the end of the day, we really don't know. There's something about being in the medical field that gives you access to a lot of different ways to end your life that other folks might not have. And so that could relate mm-hmm. to it. It's very similar to the male-female kind of difference. The biggest guess about that, and it's certainly supported in some kind of overarching way by the data, suggests that men typically use more violent methods. They use firearms predominantly more than women, although women do use firearms. And so the more lethal a method you use, the less likelihood of any rescue. And so the more likely that death will occur on those behaviors. So I think there are, we can't just say, thank goodness, just because you're a dentist, you're at a higher risk, but it's likely access to medications and knowledge of those kinds of things, coupled with other things that non-dentists go through. So it's very, again, a very complex kind of idea.
Thanks for your call, Tom.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Wendy, you're on the air. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
That's okay. You wanted to talk about the OSU Campus Suicide Program?
A little about the program and also about the ideas that we're trying to promote here on the campus, which is in the area of the gatekeeper training programs and suicide prevention by teaching the broader public about what the warning signs are and how they can intervene mm-hmm. and be more comfortable at intervening. I mean, I think part of the concerns that we have, it has to do with suicide being part of mental illness, and mental illness is generally an area that people are afraid to discuss and discuss openly. And as a result, when we see somebody that we suspect is in pain, and we don't know quite how to approach them. So one of the things that we've been doing here on campus is we have been training students, faculty, and staff how to recognize suicide warning signs and how to feel comfortable in approaching someone, particularly a student, because that's who we're concerned with on the campus. But luckily, these trainings help in all facets of their life, you know, with anyone that they come in contact with. So this has been one of the approaches that we've looked at from the federal level. This is the result of a grant that we've received from SAMHSA to focus in that area. And Mary and I have been working very closely trying to connect the greater Columbus community with the campus community around these issues.
Well, thanks for your call, Wendy.
You're welcome.
Well, I would just like to add on to that. I think that's been a great initiative that really came out of the Surgeon General's report in 1999, the movement for gatekeeper training. And one of the, I think the outgrowth of that is not only around the issue of suicide, but identifying folks who are just struggling and then reaching out to them. However, on the other side of that, what that creates is what we might call a surge in folks, you know, seeking services. but that's a good thing because we're finding folks who are having some difficulty in helping making connections to appropriate individuals who can help them out.
Mary?
Yeah, I think that, you know, suicide is a public health problem, which approach, you know, that's been since the late 1990s, has been really important because it doesn't just talk about, you know, this treatment for mental illness, but it talks about, you know, identifying risk factors, protective factors, doing education and awareness, just as they would with any other of the leading causes of death. I think that, you know, the gatekeeper thing is it's really important because oftentimes if a person is depressed, and we know that's a pretty high correlation with people who die by suicide, or many of them suffer from depression or mood disorders, that they may tend not to reach out. It's kind of part of depression to be isolating yourself and withdrawing. And so if we can, you know, get other people around them sensitized to these, you know, potential problems, if it's suicide or if it's just, you know, they're dealing with a depression, that can help them in a, you know, they may give them a chance that they wouldn't if the person, no one knew.
You know, I was in college as a bartender in a little pub, and what regular came in, his working class guy, and came in, and his business was going under, and he was very frustrated, and he spent a lot of time talking to me about how he just can't take it anymore. I just can't take it anymore. I just don't know what I'm going to do. And he wanted to be as beat his accountant, which, you know, was clearly a sign of, you know, it's clearly deranged. But I kept saying, oh, you'll be okay. You'll be okay. I don't know if any amount of training would have prepared me emotionally to see how bad off he was. He went home and he rigged a shotgun up and killed himself that night. And it's very difficult to even talk about. But I don't know, when I look back, how can you train an immature college student who wants to go out and, you know, celebrate the 4th of July the next day to listen?
I think that's a challenge, and certainly I will say some of the best training I ever had was when I went through a program like Mary overseas. It was the training for Suicide Prevention Hotline. But the ability just to say to someone like that, rather than things will be all right, hang in there, to say, gosh, it really sounds like you're struggling. Let's talk about that a little bit. That's a difficult thing to do because mm-hmm. then you open a door. And when you open that door, then you start thinking, well, what do I do next? I mean, there's even in the professional mental health field some question as to the typical ability of folks to do that in treatment. Because there's a lot of anxiety around working with someone who has suicidal thoughts and feelings and moving towards behaviors, because there's that sense of responsibility and also a limited amount of control.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a key issue is to make people comfortable about doing it or willing to ask someone directly if they're suicidal. And one of the, you know, kind of side benefits, I think, of training volunteers or training anyone actually in the agency, in the community to, you know, do crisis intervention with a suicidal person is it just gives them a comfort level. And we train like about 60 people a year that, you know, go through the 6 months of line work. And those people do go out into their communities and they are not afraid to ask. And I think with the OSU gatekeeper trainings, that's true too. The other program that we have recently begun is we work with, we actually have medical students, first-year medical students from The Ohio State University who get trained and actually work for 6 months on our line. And their response and their feedback about how it's really helped them in identifying, you know, potentially suicidal people in their, you know, the rounds and the practice stuff they do has been very, very helpful.
We have an email now from Lynn. Lynn writes, what advice would you give to friends and family members who are worried that someone they know is suicidal? Jim?
Well, I think I guess one of the maybe somewhat easy pieces here is if they're concerned, I think they should consider, number one, calling a local crisis line and talking with folks on the line about what are the available resources, how might it be best to approach that person. So I think using those resources, we have a huge network of suicide hotline crisis intervention units, you know, across the country. And they're not just, if I'm struggling, what do I do? They are very good at giving advice and guidance to folks who, like this situation brings up, you know, how do I talk to this person? So using that resource, because even if we had great ideas right now, a month down the road, you might forget about them. So using the hotline is that kind of resource. The other piece is, too, I often, you know, when I talk about some of this stuff in classes, I'll say, you know, if I go home and, you know, tell my wife that I had a, you know, horrible day and nobody listened to me and I'm thinking about taking my life, she is going to do the very same thing that Mary had talked about earlier, I think, of saying, well, you'll be all right, or you talked, I guess, and, yeah, you know, it'll get better. That's not helpful. What is helpful, right. Number one, is to say, gosh, you seem to be struggling. I'm wondering if you're thinking about killing yourself. And getting that question out there to allow the person to talk about it, rather than hiding it and avoiding it. And then say, tell me how you're feeling. Opening the door for the discussion, but then also knowing where you're going to go after that and having some sense of the resources that you can use. And that's where the hotlines can do a very good service here.
You know, that makes me think also, Mary, that you can be more specific then and talk more specifically about that person instead of in larger generalizations
sure.
like we would do
sure.
right now.
Yeah, we would we take what we call them third-party calls. We probably get at least one a day on our hotline. And ideally what we like to do is if the suicidal person is there, then we ask if they'll be willing to talk to us. And then we can kind of, you know, talk to them directly, ask all the questions, you know, and kind of give them the feedback that we've been trained to do. But even if someone has a loved one who, you know, they don't think will call a hotline, to do, as Dr. Rogers said, to, you know, ask them directly, take all threats seriously or all talk about suicide seriously and say, you know, when you say that, that really concerns me. You know, if you're feeling suicidal, we need to get you some help. And then finding help in our hotlines. The hotlines are a good place to find help because they usually have a good handle on the resources.
We have to take a short break. If you want to give a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a couple calls waiting right now. We promise we'll get to those as soon as we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
And good morning, this is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at noon, Fresh Air will be here. And on the next Fresh Air, IO USA. Within 12 years, the largest single federal expense will be interest on our national debt. But according to that's according to David Walker. He's the president and CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation and former head of the Government Accountability Office. Join us for that discussion on Fresh Air beginning at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. WOSU Public Media and the United States Census want you to be counted. Information about how it works, why it's important, and how to take part in the 2010 Census is available online at 2010census.gov. And you can get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to wosu.org/email and sign up for one of our WOSU e-newsletters. 57 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40 this morning. Sunshine today and a high near 60 degrees. Clouds tonight with a good chance of rain overnight, a low of 42. Cloudy with a good chance of rain on Wednesday as well, and a high of 58. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. All Signs with Ann Fisher continues.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, Jim Rogers, he's a professor of counseling and psychology at the University of Akron, and also Mary Brennan Hoffman. She is a suicide prevention services coordinator for the North Central Mental Health Services in Columbus. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Paul, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for having a show on this topic, number one, because it's a topic that just we need to start discussing more.
Yes.
Also, hi, Mary. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How are you, Paul?
They know who I am.
Oh, okay.
I'm a professor at OSU in counselor education, and I just finished the largest screening project for suicidality and mental health for adolescents. And ever. So we screened 12,000 high school kids in Ohio, and we had a 23% hit rate using the Columbia Teen Screen, which is an instrument used to screen for mental health issues. And that it's really disturbing to me when I looked at access to care and those sorts of things. We looked at barriers to care, and they were not financial, and it wasn't ability to access service. It was mental health stigma was still the biggest barrier of why parents didn't follow up with taking their kids in for care. And I wonder if Jim and Mary would talk a little bit about that and also about the financial aspects of, I'm not sure how Mary's budget's been affected, but mental health took a huge hit in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of preventative services right now, since we lost our federal funding, instead of screening thousands of kids like we're now screening zero. So instead of intervening with about 1,250 kids a year that we were catching before serious problems, and getting them into care, that's not happening. So I'll take my answer off the air, but just for them to talk a little bit about the whole issue of barriers to care, and then also about the financial impacts of the current cuts in mental health.
Okay, and the barriers, thank you, Paul.
Thanks.
The barriers being the stigma. Who wants to jump in first?
I will, maybe for a change, especially for the local color about the cuts, the budget cuts.
Yes.
Definitely, you know, there's still a pretty strong stigma against mental health issues. And I think parents are in a particularly kind of vulnerable position because they don't want their child, you know, shuttled off into the special needs or anything like that. And they don't want to have that what people consider some kind of a, you know, blot on their record.
Well, they wonder, is it more pain to not deal with it or more pain to deal with it and go through what they'd have to go through?
And one of the big things that we do in our presentations, and whenever we can, we speak to parent groups. So we do, my assistant does a lot of work in the schools, and he does talk about, you know, depression and mental illness in terms of it's an illness like diabetes, like asthma, like heart problems. You know, certainly it's more complex in some ways. But to try to tell the kids, you know, it's no worse or no shame, no more shame in having, you know, clinical depression than in having diabetes. You know, and of course kids have a hard time accepting that too. But
then suicide's another step.
Right. Suicide is another step. But I think Dr. Grinnella was saying about, you know, people wanting, you know, help, getting them help, is if you can get them help for the mental health issue, the suicide probably is not going to be nearly as prevalent.
Jim, did you want to?
Well, yeah, I would just like to say, you know, we've known for a very long time the problems with, you know, that stigma causes. And, you know, one of the groups, of course, that does a great job with this is NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, trying to destigmatize. And I think there's a special stigma beyond the general mental illness stigma with folks who are struggling with suicidal issues. It's, you know, things about spirituality and being crazy and some of those other kinds of things. This really does point to something that Mary had mentioned, that is a great thing that you folks are doing down there, is bringing student physicians into the training, because what we do know is that folks are more readily going to physicians when they're actually struggling with mental health issues than they will to mental health practitioners. And teaching those folks how better to identify not only general depression and issues of mental illness, but asking the questions about suicide is likely, going to get more people to the kinds of treatment that they need. Then, of course, on the other hand, you know, I had mentioned the issue of surge before, identifying people, more and more people who actually need the help. Then we have the question of paying for it. And as Paul had mentioned, you know, the funding cuts, it's really a tragedy that mental health is being cut to the extent that it is when we see an increase in those issues in society. So clearly there's no answer to that. Except that I think, again, focusing back on what do we really believe keeps someone from the brink of suicide, and I think we believe that's a connection with somebody, a caring individual, and we can do that at the grassroots level.
We're dealing very, you know, directly with the impact of the budget cuts. Almost all of the mental health centers, community mental health, in Franklin County were cut substantially, including North Central. But I think that what we're hearing is two kind of line problems. One is that people are restricted. They don't have as many funds available because they're out of work or laid off or,
right,
you know, underworking. So they aren't able to pay for their medications or their therapy or counseling. Then also that's the insurance issue, of course, that, you know, if people don't have insurance, then where do they go? They tend to go to the community mental health centers, at least here in Columbus. And, you know, they're not being funded nearly as much. So I think that might be one of the reasons why our hotlines have seen an increase in the past couple of years, is people that don't have the typical or the, you know, obvious resources to turn to. And I think NAMI and support groups and hotlines and the non-professional or the paraprofessional organizations that help people can at least fill in a little bit of the gap. I mean, you can't give a person medication or anything like that, but just in terms of the isolation, I think we can do something.
And I'll butcher it if I try. It's National Association
for the Mentally Ill.
For the Mentally Ill. Okay. Let's take another call. Jody, you're a volunteer with Suicide Hotline.
Hello.
Hi, Jody. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Thanks for waiting.
My sister died of an overdose of antidepressants in 1986 after hospitalization and lots of work with counselors. And so really, you know, until I became a volunteer in 99, that was a part of my life that I guess I felt ashamed of, or, you know, there's so much stigma with suicide. And, you know, to be in that training and around people who'd been touched by suicide, either in their own lives or by a loved one, it really helped me to kind of integrate that and heal and move on, and to be able to help other people was just a very powerful experience. And I'm grateful for the experience, and Mary does a great job, and I wanted to call in and just share that.
Well, thank you, Jody.
An unsolicited testimony.
That is interesting. How many folks, Mary, get involved because they've been affected by it themselves?
A good percentage, I would say, maybe off the top, like 20% that have a family member or someone very close. We also get people who've dealt with mental health issues, either themselves or with family members or friends that want to get involved. And I think one of the issues that Jody brought up is, you know, the survivors and taking care of the survivors. And we're very committed to doing that, too. We have a number of survivor support groups because of the stigma. You know, no one else understands, and also, you know, they're getting very negative or not helpful response from family and friends when they.
We have a couple emails, one from Kelly. Having battled it myself this winter, I am wondering the percentage of callers who deal with seasonal affective disorder. Everybody is sighing with relief these last 5 days because the sun is finally out. I mean, we're in the cloudiest city in the universe, I think.
Is Akron worse?
Well, I think we're worse.
Okay.
Northern Ohio, so.
It's good for the complexion, but not much else. Mary, do you think, I mean, is that just kind of anecdotal type of thing?
Dr. Rogers might be able to answer from a research point of view, and then I'll answer from a personal point of view afterwards.
Well, I really can't speak very authoritatively about that. I'm not aware of any, you know, research that talks about seasonal affective disorder in general. I do know that that you know, we have this tendency to struggle through some of these, you know, the winter months. There's really not a strong pattern, though, of suicide by month that I'm really aware of. I think it fluctuates a lot. There used to be the idea that there were a lot more suicides around the winter holidays, but those were just anecdotal statements. So.
Okay.
Definitely. I would totally agree about the seasonal thing as being not, there's no research. We keep the records of the Franklin County suicides, and I was just looking over the past 10 years, and, you know, the male-female rate didn't change at all. It was almost always about 80-20, but the months did fluctuate, you know, much more directly. As far as seasonal depression goes, we do get callers who, you know, say that, you know, it's worse because of this. And so, I mean, I think it's one more.
Okay. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests are Jim Rogers, professor of counseling and psychology at the University of Akron, and also Mary Brennan Hoffman. She is suicide prevention services coordinator at North Central Mental Health Services. We have an email from Betsy. She writes, I have had serious suicidal thoughts a couple of times. They occurred before having medication and then during a medication change many years later. I had gone as far as knowing how and when both times. For suicidology, do you take people with that background for study? Jim?
Well, that's been something that's really beginning to change. We had a strong history in research of being really reluctant to take to include actively suicidal or kind of high-risk folks because of, you know, the potential that whatever we were looking at in terms of treatment or understanding would exacerbate, would make those issues worse for them. Mm-hmm. However, we've certainly come to know that unless we include in our research folks who are at a high risk, that we are not going to learn the things that we need to learn. So that's somewhat changing. We did the same thing, too, in suicidology in general with folks who have lost a loved one to suicide survivors. We know that being a suicide survivor can be very, certainly a very tragic kind of experience and can be difficult to deal with. But we had been, in the past, reluctant to really try to understand the survivor experience because of fears that we might make that worse for them. But we have, again, I think, moving in the area of saying, if we really want to know and we really want to help, we have to include these folks.
And I like to say that the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is the 1-800 national number, we're a network center. they do have kind of an interest in the attempters, and they have had conferences or done some work with talking to attempters and getting their perspective and how things would help and that. So maybe it's very slowly kind of infiltrating a little bit.
Well, there's some great work coming out of Switzerland. There's a group over there called the ASCII group from ASCII, Switzerland, that they have for a number of years been interviewing folks who have made suicide attempts and trying to understand from a real interpersonal perspective what that is like and also what the experience of going into treatment is like. So trying to take a very more humanistic approach to the issue rather than a strict clinical kind of approach. And I think that's one of the movements in the field that's going to pay off in the long run.
Let's take another call. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513. And, John, you are on the air with Jim Rogers and Mary Brennan Hoffman.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'd like to say as a child it would have been so helpful if my parents had provided for me the kind of counseling that is really necessary. But it was shameful at the time to do it, and parents felt like somehow they had not fulfilled their responsibility. When I was 58, I'm 78 now, I began to get counseling. And I want to say how grateful I am and how free I feel, and what a blessing it's been to have others know what I'm going through and listen carefully. I would just hope that the culture, particularly congregations, religious groups, would be willing to talk about it openly and to encourage people to find the resources that are available, whether they're lay or professional.
Thanks, John. John, what finally, when you were 58, what was the trigger for you to get help at that age?
Well, it was just so miserable. Clinical depression was just so miserable that there didn't seem to be any other way to deal with it. I wasn't getting any better, and it was very painful. I really didn't think about suicide, but it was the pain of it and the way it disrupted my life. And also I would like to say how grateful I am to the therapists who have been really thoughtful and really wise, and the people who encouraged me to get that kind of assistance.
Well, John, that's very nice of you to talk about on the air. I hope that other folks hear that, and it takes a lot of courage to. Sometimes it takes a lot of courage to go into treatment, but it certainly takes a lot to talk about your experience. So, thank you.
Yeah. Well, I guess I feared if I talked about it, they might put me in a mental hospital or something disastrous like that. And it was really such. It was kind of an ignorance on my part, but nevertheless, that's operative in a lot of people's psyches, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when people share stories like yours, John, it really is inspirational to people who are going through something similar to see, well, here's a guy who, you know, been dealing with it, obviously, for many, many years, and it wasn't too late for you to get help and have another 20 years, free from some of that pain of clinical depression. So I appreciate your sharing your story, too.
John, thanks for your call so much.
Thank you.
Take care. We're going to have to take the permanent break here, I'm sorry to say. I want to thank my guest, Jim Rogers, professor of psychology and counseling at the University of Akron. He is also president of the American Association of Suicidology. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann, very much.
And also, Mary Brennan Hoffman, she is Suicide Prevention Services Coordinator at North Central Mental Health Services. Thanks, Mary, for being with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories heard today on WOSU comes from the law offices of Porter Wright Morrison Arthur LLP, helping businesses and individuals solve complex legal problems throughout Ohio, across the country, and around the world. On the web at porterwright.com.